I would always tell clients, like, look, man, I know we're encrypting your data, but we have to decrypt it somewhere. And get decrypted in memory. And if somebody's root on a machine, you can run some simple commands and you can look at what they're looking at in memory.
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial? It's time to get adversarial.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Adversarial Podcast. Good to be on the air. As always, let's launch right in. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about. First of all, hello, Mario and Sunil. What's new in your neck of the woods, Mario?
Just plugging away, growing the company, hiring people, struggling to hire people, et cetera, et cetera. That's what I'm in right now.
We might talk about that a little bit on the episode today. Very good. Sunil, tell us what's that beautiful background and what you're up to.
Yeah, I'm actually in Munich today. There's a security conference this weekend. But before that, there's a cybersecurity conference, and I was asked to speak here. So able to enjoy lovely Munich. I've been here in Munich 20-plus times, so it's a great city, one of my favorite cities in Europe. Always enjoy coming this way.
Wow. I'm just curious because, I mean, we've both been in cybersecurity for a long time, for like 20-plus years, and I've never been to Munich. Is it cybersecurity that's been bringing you there, or personal, or a mix?
No. There's a big conference called the Munich Security Conference, and there's actually a fairly large U.S. delegation from the administration here for the Munich Security Conference. But it brings a whole bunch of bigwigs into town. Mm. I mean, it's a pretty significant security perimeter around the hotel that they hosted at.
Oh, wow.
I was trying to get through. I got almost all the way through. Anyway, but there were people with guns.
BMW is there, isn't it? The BMW headquarters is
there. Yeah, it's in Munich, yes. Yeah. But I was talking, you know, it's funny. I was talking to one of their security team members, and they said, you know, BMW, the organization just moves really slow. I'm like, you probably mean the inner workings of the organization, not the cars. But with the Munich Security Conference, there's a bunch of side events, and the Munich Cybersecurity Conference is what I'm at. And we had Sean Cairncross, the National Cyber Director, kick it off, give his perspectives on the upcoming national strategy, which hasn't been released yet, and a whole bunch of other talking heads.
Wow. I got grilled for 4 hours in the BMW engineering, technology engineering team about security. So I had to go in there, and for 4 hours I was in, felt like I was being interrogated. Typically, you all know the drill. And so I found them to be very, very smart.
Oh, this is like TPRM, you mean, when you're selling?
Yeah, they brought me in before. They were concerned about it. They wanted to make sure that they knew what they were getting themselves into. They asked me all the security questions. 4 hours. 4 freaking hours, all right, man? It was intense.
Yeah.
So I have a lot of respect for them.
Oh, wow, that's funny. Yeah, you know, I was just going through, we do SOC 2, and we're on our second year of it, and I was just going through some evidence stuff that was assigned to me. And it was like, provide evidence that the hiring plan for the company is very well thought out and strategized. So I'm just mentioning this because you said, like, getting grilled for 4 hours gives you respect for, and I'm thinking about what we do in TPRM. And so, like, I turned on that and, like, went to a chief security officer Slack. I was like, this is what we're doing. This is how we're assuring security, everyone. We're making sure our vendors have a plan for hiring and roadmap for who to hire. Like, how has this happened? And then the conversation went into, well, the SOC 2 standard is run by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants. So what do you expect? Right,
the old AICPA, AICPAs, like, you know,
that's who's running the standards for cybersecurity. It's a bad state. So I don't know how that 4 hours of BMW went, or if it really ascertained security of what
it was.
You
all technical. It was all technical. They went in. They wanted to know about encryption. They wanted to understand how we were handling. Anyway, so it was all technical. I'm not talking about wasted, like, you know, code of conduct.
Hiring plan.
I'm saying code of conduct.
Well, hold on. But I would also just say, just as well say, if it's a technical interview, like that kind of interview, why even be asking a person? I would rather just say, run this, give me the report.
Huh. I think sometimes people do that because they want to, honestly, they want to see who's behind the security scene in a program, and they want to know that they can look at your eyes and trust that you're not bullpucking them. That's been my sense when they send me out to these places. And it's not like I'm easy on people's eyes. I am not. Okay. Trust me.
Oh, look at this guy, everybody. Yeah, shut it down. We're good.
Trust me.
Hey, for what it's worth, I have personal experience in this because I met Mario during one of these multi-hour technical grills, and we did not, I want to keep talking about this for a minute, Sunil, and about what you would run if you're doing this, but we did not run anything. I don't know what we would have run. We did get comfort from Mario because he was brilliant. He was audio only, so we didn't even see him. So everything just passed with flying colors.
Right, wait, I'm sorry. Are you saying that Mario has a face for radio?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. A face for face for conference calls
that even my own mother wouldn't like. My mother got slapped by the doctor when I was born because I was so ugly.
Well, I remember this is actually pretty interesting. So, like, my team was TPRMing his team, and then they asked me to join in. And honestly, like, I kind of remember this is kind of ashamed about this, but I can remember like you don't remember what was said or what you saw, but you remember how you felt, right?
Yeah.
And that's certainly true for me. And I remember feeling like, oh, come on, who? You know, what do we got to do? I'm busy, whatever. And it was literally in, we had a whole, this is an interesting topic too for Fortune 500 CISOs, but we had a physical floor designated to third-party access. So there was like no internal network. And that's where we'd put regulators who wanted to camp out. Like, you want to sit here for 3 weeks? Go ahead, but you're not going to be able to drink our coffee, right? And so for some reason, there must have been someone visiting from Snowflake 2 in person because they were down on that floor. But Mario, yeah, that's right. And there was a nice big boardroom. And then Mario was, coming over the audio. And I used to think it was because he was too snooty to fly out to Atlanta. And now I know it's because he didn't want to see his face. But in any event, I went in there. And I remember in about 15 minutes being like, these guys are good. Let's just go. So something that happened made me say, like, gave me all the, without doing a bunch of technical tests and asking a bunch of questionnaires, like, and I think it was basically like, these guys aren't flying blind. They totally understand about encryption, data encryption. I'm sure it was something very practical, like, no, we're not going to encrypt everything. That'd be silly. But, and I'm like, oh, wow, we're talking real and not lies and that kind of thing. So if that could be distilled into TPRM, the sniff test, so to speak, that'd be great. But Sunil, what would you run on a company today, and would that have been possible 15 years ago if you were going to analyze data or do something analytical?
Okay, well, there are a couple of things. First is like a PCAP, for example. Just give me PCAPs at certain parts of the in certain places within your organization.
Wait, pause there. Let's go. Okay,
but the fact that whether you can even create one is part of the challenge, right? That's the first challenge. It's sort of like, are you even this high?
That's the thing. The test I always use. I think I've said on the podcast before. Like, I would want to say, like, can you put this little code on your website somewhere? And can you do a meta tag that says, you know, 4 Jerry = 7, whatever, on your website? And I think a lot of companies couldn't do that. And to me, that's a security problem, like remediation, agility, the ability to actually get anything done. Is that all it is? Or would you actually want to see network traffic?
Well, no. I mean, I don't really care about the network traffic.
Okay.
Right. It's more
about...
Because
then you get into where you're taking it from and how do you trust them and how do you understand the network.
And then if we're looking at, what ciphers you're using, again, I can ask you, but in theory, I should be able to get that straight from the PCAP too, right?
Yeah.
I think the question you asked me was whether we could see your data. I think it might have been one of those. I don't know if that was you or somebody. And our answer to that was, go ahead. Sorry, Sunil.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. So what you're referring to is more about the overall processes that you have internally, like architectural processes of how do you actually handle customer data? And if, for example, the question of, like, walk me through how does one gain access to a customer data and how is that audited? Okay.
Yeah.
And that's a great question to ask.
Yeah. Yeah,
because now you're talking at a procedural level rather than at a technical, like, tell me what cipher keys are you using.
Yeah. I think it was something not along those lines, but it was about whether, can we see your data? Yeah. And my answer was, well, there are two ways. You know, two ways when I was a snowflake. One, you got to invite us in. I used to say, you got to, I mean, we're like Dracula. You have to let us in through the front door, okay. Right? You literally grant us access. And then you give us the right the kind of permissions to help you out. That's the front door. That's the approved door. But yep. I would always tell clients, like, look, man, I know we're encrypting your data, but we have to decrypt it somewhere and get decrypted in memory. And if somebody's root on a machine, you can run some simple commands and you can look at what they're looking at in memory. Okay? Yeah. So what I can tell you is that's going to happen, but at least I'm monitoring it. And I can tell you if they did it and they shouldn't do
that. That's the right answer. Yeah. Yeah. To say it's completely impossible is stupid. If it's end-to-end encrypted, that's great. Then it's just Glacier. It's just storage. It's not, you're not doing anything with the data. You got to see the data if you're going to do anything with it. Yeah, I think so.
By the way,
Sunil, I paused you at PCAP. Are there any other things that in today's environment you would want to be able to do if you could?
Well, actually, there's an interesting manifestation of, there's an interesting trend that's worth noting here. So when we talk about TPRM, again, there's the technical controls, but a lot of times what we're really looking for is procedural controls. Okay, I think that's why we have the interviews. But here's something that's remarkable that's happening. There's a lot more adoption of agentic systems. Okay, and when you create an agentic system, what you're also instructing these systems to do is to follow a set of procedures. Yeah. And those procedures, whether written down in Markdown, more and more is being written down in Markdown, and you're giving, you're doing a form of context engineering to ensure that it knows what it needs to do. What's remarkable is that it's now being more documented, and whatever documentation you have is now, for the most part, being adhered to through these agentic systems.
Yeah.
So
what's the prompt?
What's really, through the prompt and through the context that you give it. So what I'm saying here in the end is that in the past, we would ask them, you know, give me your policy or procedures, and how do I ensure know that you're actually following this? We need to now be asking that question of agents as well. And I actually think that those agents, we're starting to see more controls around how to ensure that those agents are operating as you expect it to operate. And the verification of that process is something that is actually easily verifiable. There's a validation activity that we're doing when we do these interviews. The validation activity is that the actual process that we want, that we like? Okay. There's a verification of, are you actually doing that process? But the reason why we have these stupid TPRM stuff is because we want to also determine, is that the right process?
Well, the bupaki smell, right? This is the thing. This is what I interrupted you, Jerry.
Go for it.
This is the one thing where documenting something and saying you're doing it, even if it's silly, but you demonstrate that you're doing it, is really important, because at least there's a trust factor for me, when I look at vendors. Tell me the good, tell me the bad, and tell me the ugly. If you got bad and ugly, tell me how you fix it, because everybody has bad and ugly. Just tell me how you did it, how quickly, what it took. And if you say you're doing something and you put it in writing, you better make sure you're doing that, because you lose credibility real quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're like dancing around and like walking into something really good here. So, first of all, I'll contend that most of the procedural documentation you get through like a TPRM process is fallacious. It's not.
Agreed.
Followed whatsoever. And a really good example of that would be, there's a NIST standard on incident response. I just quick Googled. I think it's 861. Yeah. And I've seen companies who, what happens is they don't have anything at all. And then they're going to go through, it's usually ISO that forces them to like have an incident response standard. And then they download that. And it's something like 85 pages. And then they say that's what they do. And then two things happen. Like, if you read through that, and if you, you know, go on sabbatical so you could read the document and then return to work 3 weeks later, it asks for this massive amount of paperwork and all the stuff around an incident. So then people either completely, and most of the time the incident responders did not know their company's telling customers about 861. They don't even read that because they're busy responding to incidents, and it's just ridiculous. But if you do want to follow it and paper everything up to that extent, then you draw this subjective artificial threshold for what becomes an incident so that you're only doing this four times a year. Because you can't do this like 16, you can't do this on every DLP hit, on every fish report. Like you can't write up all this crap. It'd be, there's not enough time. To, and God forbid someone invent an AI agent to write it all, because that's going to be even worse, because no one's never have AI agents reading it too, and it's stupid. So what I usually find is either they don't do anything at all, or they write up these beautiful, lengthy reports, but there's only like four of them, and you know there's a lot more stuff that went on in it. So I don't love it. To Sunil's point, though, like we're doing this awesome stuff right now where we generate procedures, and we call it a rubric, and it's meant for a human to read, and it's incident response, and it says, like, here's the things. And it was meant to be very streamlined, like a thing that someone could run all day, every day on hundreds of incidents and not have to write a report with a table of contents and a preface and a forward. But we actually take that and jam it in every prompt. It's like an embedding in the prompt. And we did it because LLMs are awful at security, because they were trained by all the people that talk about security for the last 20 years. So everything's a panic. If you just go off the LLMs and you say, hey, there's an alert from Microsoft saying suspicious login, what do you think this is? It would be like, call the police. Like that's the LLM response to everything, because it's trained on all this mania and FUD that the industry has cranked out. So we put together this really hard procedure to say, hey, LLM, you're really good at making complete sentences. Hold on to that. But when it comes to cybersecurity, here's your rubric. Only ignore everything you've ever learned. Here it is. And the result of that is there's a couple of cool things. One is that if somebody audits a firm like that and they get the document how they do incident response, the evidence will back it up, because the AI is applying the very rubric. It's filling every field that was specified. It's judging SEV 54321 by exactly what it said. And that's, even if that existed for a moment in time, practice divorces from procedure, you know, just through actual response normally. So I think that's awesome. But it also gives light to something else, which is in evaluating good AI use cases, especially in security, I think there's a spectrum of probabilism to through determinism. And what I just described was adding determinism to a process that was very probabilistic. Using AI, we're more deterministic. That's counterintuitive, right? Because everybody thinks AI is being probabilistic. Yeah. A bunch of guys in a room putting their finger in the air on whether this incident is worth telling the CFO about, that's super probabilistic. So I think that's a really cool litmus test, especially for investors looking at AI use cases, is does this actually add order to a chaotic situation? And I think that there's opportunities for that.
I got a story about this whole security incident that went through myself. Okay, so stay with me a little bit.
Go.
Again, I'm going to paraphrase Jerry and Sunil, especially Sunil. I think I'm going to paraphrase him. The more complex you create something, the more complexity, the more potential for issues to arrive. Sunil, is that okay? Is that a fair statement?
What I would say is that complexity is an emergent phenomenon. So the more that you incorporate different pieces to something, you end up having emergent behavior, and that emergent behavior is what we can't anticipate.
Okay, so for me, then, I try to do the very basic things. So when I first created an incident, I actually did the incident process for the company early on, and I wanted to just keep it simple. Two, maybe three pages at most, simple, very black and white, as much as possible when you can. And that worked for many years. Because why? Because I want my incident people to react quickly. If they see something, let's bubble it up, go to the right place, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Right? The lawyers, as we got old, as a company, the lawyers got involved and they wanted to manage the incident response documentation. I'm like, because they weren't happy with how simple our incident response was, documentation wise. And it's just a battle over like for months. And then I said, okay, fine, you go write it. So they write it. And I had my entire incident response team almost quit on me, because it's just worthless. In fact, they never even looked at it.
Lawyers are used to doing that.
Exactly. And I think it was, I don't know who we hired, I think it was Mandy or somebody, I can't remember. We were doing some tabletops and they looked at our incident response that was created by the lawyers. I'm not going to say GC, I'm going to get in trouble. The lawyers, our lawyers. And the first thing they said, this is worthless. You really can use it in an incident.
Thank you. That became a standard.
That was so like, you're worth every dime.
Never was. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. A good example of that was we had in the incident response standard, I specifically never called out any regulators. I was like, come on, the analysts don't need to deal with that. And how are we going to keep up? And finally, someone really pushed hard to call out I think it was the SEC. It was, the SEC has all these incident report notification things. Let's put it in the incident response plan. I'm like, that's ridiculous. The analysts will never we don't want them ever talking to the SEC and so on. No, but, we're going to give this doc when we're examined. So we wanted to say that, push hard against it. We did it finally, begrudgingly. Who cares? Hey, everybody, don't worry about that part. It just is some stuff. Year later, year and a half, we're in an examination by the CFTC.
Oh.
Hey, I see this regulator section and we're not mentioned. Oh. Finding, right? You can't win with that crap. Yeah, and that was just them. There were 10 other regulators who I'm sure would have been on the same path if we didn't get a chance to rip it out. So I was talking about AI and its use. And one of the topics we wanted to talk about was your hiring here, Mario. We started talking about this before we went on the air. You're in an AI startup, so I have my own opinions about what AI hiring means for me. Sunil certainly will. What is it that you want to get out of an engineer when it comes to AI skills, and how do you? What's the challenge you're facing?
I think we've kind of seen this pattern. If you are in the industry long enough, like us, we're old, you get to see these themes happen every so often, and it's themes around a new technology that's taking over. And there is a chasm between those folks who are holding on to, previous technology, not making that migration to the newer technology. So they're really great at whatever they're doing, but it just doesn't translate as well, or they haven't made the effort to translate that as well. And so what's that? What does that mean? So today, we're trying to hire ICs just like everybody else, probably in San Francisco. It's crazy. We fire external exec, headhunters, even for ICs, and we're getting, we're interviewing 3 to 4 a week. And I'm looking at these results of these interviews, and we don't have a lot of people to be wasting interviewing people, okay? We have to go write code, and we have to do engineering work. And I'm looking at just the message, the results, and it's dawning on me that what people are putting in their resumes are like, I've got an AI, I've been working on AI, I'm looking for a generalist full stack person, but with AI experience as well. And what does that AI mean? What people will put is pet projects, or they're working for an enterprise company, somebody not on-prem, maybe on-prem, a little cloud, but they haven't built anything that's really AI specific for like the company selling that product, but rather maybe a feature, internal feature that's kind of somebody's pet project. And that's what we're seeing. And they're just not able, their existing full stack generalist experience is not able to translate well at a scale. And that's the big problem we're seeing at the moment. And so I came out with an idea, my own stupid idea, and says, I'm looking for an IC4. I'm probably want to go see somebody who's got 7 to 10 years, not because that means a lot, but I just look for somebody with 7 to 10 years because I'm looking for an IC4.
Not 7 to 10 years of AI. You're talking about 7 to 10 years of technology, of working.
That's right.
Yes.
That's
otherwise, great. Otherwise, you'd be looking for somebody, someone with 14 years of Kubernetes.
That's correct. That's right. Exactly it, Sunil. Sorry, you were right. You corrected me before the episode. 7 years total of experience. But at least in the last year or 2 years, doing an actual AI, working probably for an AI company. And you're saying, well, Mario, there's not that many AI companies all of a sudden start showing up, but they weren't around 3-4 years in that frequency. And you're right. I'll say you're right. But a lot of companies are dying or being acquired. And so you can pick some people that have worked in these companies that are really talented, that have actually worked on deploying AI solutions as a product, as a company product. And those are the ones that I'm looking for.
Let me ask you this though. I'm at Georgia Tech a lot. We hire out of Georgia Tech. And we're lucky we get people that are specialized in ML in particular. And we're fighting with OpenAI because they're going to go there and work on models. I'm not going to use them for that. Their skills are going to be squandered here at Adversarial Risk Management. We're not building models. I'll admit that. We are in AI all day, every day. But I'll concede we're doing prompt engineering. A lot of the AI work is just good old APIs, concurrency, parallelism, performance. How do I run 600 prompts at the same time and actually get them back? How do I make them faster? And that's not super AI-ish. The actual prompts and figuring out, being able to compare different models and like get some statistical data and be able to come back and be like, oh, if we move to this model here, it'll cost us X more, but we'll perform this much better. Those are all not AI skills. Like everything I'm talking about is basically like software engineering or SRE type skill set. Whereas tuning an actual model, like someone who would be working in the bowels of OpenAI, is a different skill set. Which one are you looking for? And are you artificially limiting yourself to the latter pool if really what you need is the former?
Before I say that, and maybe you guys have heard this, but if you heard of Cloud Wrapper, your company's just a wrapper around Claude or OpenAI. Have you heard that?
Yeah, right.
That term?
Yeah.
And so VCs are starting to say, well, if you're just that, then we're not, you know, why am I going to put money in? And so they think, you need to research it. But the reality, they'll say, I want to see if you have researchers. Why? You want me to create new models? Like, how am I going to do create new models and compete against these behemoths? Maybe if I'm specializing in something, maybe that's where you can go vertical, right? You're really deep into a particular vertical. Maybe you have to create your own models. But otherwise, most of the models, we're just piggybacking on what the OpenAIs and the Anthropics of the world and Geminis of the world are doing.
I think they...
Sunil, I'm really curious about you because I think you're a pure play AI
might
company,
be different.
So
correct.
Where are you on that?
Yeah. So there are a couple things to be mindful of. Investors are looking for a company that has a moat. And the wrapper that you're talking about is not much of a moat. But let me also re-describe what that wrapper is. That wrapper is effectively the scaffolding that we provide to the prompt, but the context engineering that we're also seeing includes additional scaffolding around how I want something to be created. That scaffolding is essentially... a form of that scaffolding is really a planning and a form of structure that you expect managers to actually know how to do. So what I'm trying to get at is what exactly is an IC today? An IC that actually knows how to use AI systems extraordinarily well. That IC is actually not really an IC. They're a manager, okay? And they're a manager of other AI systems. Now, they may have no humans to have to do reviews for, which, you know, that's one of the most painful parts of being a manager. But you are looking for managerial skills. How do you organize work? How do you ensure that the work gets done properly? How do you validate that the work, how do you verify that work was done
Brilliant.
Correctly? How do
Brilliant.
You validate that what was created is actually what you want, right? All those are managerial skills that I think we're now asking ICs to do.
Brilliant.
And a lot of ICs don't actually have that skill.
When I joke around that one of our engineers, I said, hey, you and your 100 minions, right? So that's what he has. And he has minions that are focusing on specific areas of engineering for him. And so he's right. Sunil's right. It's like an architect manager managing these agents, AI agents, to do X work.
Yeah. And I think one of the challenges that we're going to see also in the context of what makes a good manager, what makes a good architect, if you consider the career progression, an architect is someone who has spent the time engineering and understands all the failure modes that they've encountered and thus says, okay, I now have a better sense of how to architect this thing. And unfortunately, we're shortchanging the opportunity for entry-level folks to have that experience, partly because they just turn to an AI model to build things and not actually learn. They're not training the critical thinking part of their brain, or rather, we're not giving them the opportunity to exercise the critical thinking part of their brain to learn these skills to become the kind of architect that we have today. But we're gonna quickly run into the COBOL problem where you have all these people who are aging and nobody who's gonna fewer people who are gonna be able to have those skills going forward.
Let me follow up with something, Sunil. And under those things that you just mentioned, do you need to create new models? I don't I don't hear that, you know? I mean,
no, actually, let me give you the answer to that question is consider Claude Code when it first came out under Opus 3.5, okay? Between the point that it was released to when Opus 4.0 came out, okay, we saw dramatic improvements in the ability of Claude Code. And it wasn't the model that changed. It was all the scaffolding and all the ways that we understood how to build things, okay, and how to instruct these AI agents to build things. Now, the equivalent of that is we were building buildings with wood, okay? And we learned how to build buildings with wood, and we learned what causes them to fall apart and blah, blah, blah. And then Opus 4.6 comes out, and now we're building with metal. Okay. Yeah. And so some of the building codes that we had for wood, you know, they don't apply as much. Okay. But we do now have new building codes that we'll now come up with that work for metal as opposed to with wood. Okay. But
what's the name of that game? The board where you build empires. Is that empire building? And you start with wood or like cave people, and then you grow to wood and then become stone. You know what I'm talking about? That's kind of what's happening really quickly.
Well, what I'm also articulating is that the underlying technology, whether wood, stone, metal, whatever, you know, that's going to remain constant for a long time.
Yeah.
And what develops and what improves is our fundamental understanding of how to do this well. Okay. Going back to the notion of a wrapper, it's improving the wrapper, but oftentimes in even expressing what that improvement is or what that scaffolding is, you've actually given away the wrapper.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, think about this one just on that comment on the scaffolding and getting better at it. Anthropic released caching back in November of last year. And what it does is instead of using tokens, constantly pigging for new tokens, because every time you go and ask, it doesn't remember necessarily. You have to go and ping and you generate new tokens. And every time you generate new tokens, you spend money. That's how you spend money. And it's a lot of money. But now our team has gotten more sophisticated on that, saying, hi, if we continue this thing, we're going to run out of cash. That's just the nature of it. So why don't we implement caching? And caching is about 10 to 1 less costly than if you were just doing token. And caching is just, think about it like a CDN. I'm sorry, this is a very brute example, but just think of a CDN, but for AI. And Sunil and Jerry, please keep me honest. But that's an example. Sorry, Jerry, go ahead.
No, that's something we run into without a doubt. And but I'll tell you, in our usage of it, it has been 95% of the value from caching has been around performance more than cost. Like the cost was kind of negligible. Mm. But the idea is if the same person's asking the same thing about the same set of facts, why are we wasting any time? And it's been super powerful. And the kind of weird little knock-on is that at least as someone in the guts, I notice like I can tell someone's asked a question before by the speed of response because of the cache.
Oh, interesting.
Kind of weird. Yeah, it's kind of. Well, let me ask you, like, back to the wrapper talk, though. So, and we're going to get great SEO because I said wrapper, and someone's going to think we're talking about Snoop Dogg now, but we're back to the wrapper talk.
Hey, don't call it a comeback. We've been here for years, Jerry.
Yeah, let's keep going with this. Yeah. But, like, when you think about, let's talk about this. So, like, a company like Harvey AI, right? It's legal services AI.
Yeah.
Now put that aside for a minute. Now let's think about law firms. Pre-AI, there were preeminent law firms that people considered the best at a given niche, right? Let's say IP law, whatever it's going to be. And it was always like, hey, you know, you could go by an unknown quantity or you can go to this middle tier that are all going to probably be pretty good. Or you could spend top dollar and this is the firm, And it was always that. And the individual partners, if they moved, like the business would move with them and all of that. And it was supposedly in their institutional knowledge and their body knowledge and their experience. And that was supposed to be really unique. Now, if you take a new, and Harvey may be the case, I've never used them. But if you take a wrapper, if you will, then it's going to do legal work by hammering it against an LLM. And it's going to take, hey, here's this contract I got from opposing counsel. Can you go through there and tell me any gotchas? And it can easily like delta the red lines and see if they're trying to sneak something in. But it could also just say like, hey, here's a summary of what they're asking for and whether or not that's normal compared to all the body of knowledge out there. Now, does that key partner, is that unique subject matter expertise? If there's a firm that's implementing AI and they distill that partner's knowledge and they have them codifying it and embedding it into the prompts and making outputs that would not have come with just the true large language model, and instead it's at when you use this wrapper,
correct, firm,
you're getting different answers because they and only they have privileged, unique, exclusive access to the smartest guys in the room. Is that a real thing? Is that sustainable?
That's a really good
question.
Or are
we all going to converge towards just the LLM of everything? Is expertise a thing anymore? Well,
so what you're talking about is also represented in the current stock decline of all the SaaS applications or the SaaS providers, where where people are now seeing, obviously, the LLM as the engine that you can put a wrapper around to basically do some of the same SaaS functions that you that we rely upon today. SaaS isn't going to go away. Rather, what's gone away is the potential potential growth path for the SaaS companies, and that's what we're seeing as a decline. People are still going to use SaaS, but I think the opportunity for new platforms that emerge that operate on the large language models is what people are starting to move their money to within the stock market. I think that also, I think the opportunity to also pivot away from those companies does become an interesting thing too, because now you have a wrapper, you have an interoperability wrapper around different types of, between different vendors. Before I had vendor lock-in, because I had to adhere to this particular vendor specifications. But if I now have a higher level way to articulate what my business outcomes are, I can then have the LLM work with whatever vendor I'm using. I don't have to use vendor A versus vendor B.
Yes. Yeah. I call that BYOLLM. Right. So the idea is if we embed all of the institutional knowledge into the prompt stream, then you could point it. And it's not just that you could, it's about quasi-determinism. It's about getting consistent answers despite the LLMs changing.
Yeah, there's another framing for it, which is bring your own context or be the system of not record, but system of context. And this is where we're seeing, we're starting to see companies like ServiceNow move towards.
ServiceNow, I just had a conversation with somebody inside ServiceNow and they're going after Salesforce, which is really interesting.
Oh, that is interesting.
Well, and being that system of context.
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah, within the context and within the perspective of, like, we talk about system of record when it comes to asset management, but there's not one same system of record, right? We have multiple systems of record.
Yeah.
And what we're really looking for, what we've always wanted in asset management is not, you know, I have a database of all these servers and whatnot, because that tells you one thing. What we really actually want to know is, what does the system do?
Or how does it communicate with the other systems? And what is the movement of process data between them and decision-making?
Such that if I were to patch the system or that a patch were to take it offline, you now have a better understanding of the consequences.
Correct.
Right. Yeah. You know, this is very close to heart for me because we talk about this every day. So we have this... open book here, right? We have this notion of a synthesized CMDB, right? So the idea is the CMDB idea in the past was there's so many back to like talking heads and LLMs being fed with FUD. The top one is that the number one thing in cybersecurity you have to do when you start a cybersecurity program is get inventory. And I think that's complete bogus nonsense. You'll never get inventory. You don't even, what are you going to get? All the servers? No one's used servers anymore. Like, you don't even know what the entities are. And if you somehow can get a static inventory written somewhere, it'll be useless. And you don't need a, how many books do you need in a library? One, the one you want to read right now, right? Yeah. It's at the time that you're actually going to make use of it that you need to dynamically come up with the inventory. And when I was helping with incident response, and that's another a key area when you want to know about assets, right? Hey, supposedly this asset either was targeted or hit or compromised or emoted some odd behavior. And at that point, you want to know things like, what is this thing used for? Is it processing production data? What applications is it a part of? Is it internet exposed? Who are the users on it? And that sort of stuff. And during incident response, I think most seasoned incident responders would find those details in Jira, in email retention archives, right? You'd say, because if you went to the CMDB, it would say like, oh, this was a, you know, X server that had this IP address when we built inventory 3 years ago, and that's the end of it. If you go to Jira and you go to email and all of that, you find, hey, I'm thinking about promoting this to prod this weekend. Is it approved? Yeah, but make sure you don't forget it also has that legacy app. Like, that's the stuff that you can't afford to pre-position.
Totally.
But you really can reactively, at any given moment, say, what is this? And synthesize the CMDB for your purposes at that very moment.
You know, and
LLM just massively help with that, I would say.
We try to avoid pitching each other's or our own products, okay, our own company's products. But so I'm a little bit, a little unfair stuff here that I'm doing. If you haven't looked at Jerry's company, I really encourage you to look at it. Okay, because it's a really thoughtful. I'm looking to use them as my vendor, because I'm tired of all these threat modeling and where you should go focus and blah blah blah, and it's just cumbersome. I love when you have a person like Jerry and Sunil, and you understand how they think. Their product naturally represents their thinking, and if you want to do something modern, you don't want to get stuck in crap and minutia of stupid paperwork. You don't want to do that, but you actually want to do security work. Go look at these folks' company. I'm as a user of them. So
you're
a fair
time,
pitch.
Though.
Sorry, Jerry.
Oh, that's awesome.
We never do this.
No, that's right. That's right. But I appreciate it if it's organic. Hey, so we've been talking about AI for a while, and we actually had a, and we were riffing, but we have a prepositioned topic about AI too. So the Google Threat Intelligence Group, maybe GTIG, AI Threat Tracker. I saw this published come out 48 hours ago because of Charles Carmichael. He had, the CTO at Mandiant, he had shared this via LinkedIn, and it got promoted pretty quick. But it's basically an update on AI-based threats from the people who would know best, Mandiant. And when I read through this report, my takeaway was nothing new or breaking except for reverse engineering models, which I kind of felt like, A, that's probably not super effective, and B, it probably is of no concern to most lay people. True? What do you think?
Well, in terms of effectiveness, I would say actually it's extraordinarily effective relative to the costs of building your own model. So the specific attack that, for those who aren't familiar, I think was they detected 100,000 queries being made to Gemini. And they're especially crafted queries, not like human queries, but specially crafted queries that would help surface what the model weights might be. And it's not a perfect extraction of those weights per se, but it's what's called a distillation attack. And the basic value proposition is, you know, for if I were to get the most premium model of Gemini, 100,000 queries is peanuts, right? Relative to the actual cost of building this model. So, from a cost effectiveness standpoint, it's absolutely cost effective for the attacker standpoint, and it's also extraordinarily hard from the defender to prevent a distillation attack. There essentially is no meaningful protection against a distillation attack. We think that the DeepSeek was to some degree a distillation attack as well. I mean, the creation of this DeepSeek was through distillation methods.
So just to be clear, you're saying hammering queries to deduce how the model's built and being able to recreate, create a serviceable clone of that model. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. That's
but I mean, from the little I understand about how you would create models and train on data and preposition the data so that you could have algorithms that parse through it and look for adjacency, it doesn't stand to reason to me that you could back into that from the responses to a very finite set of questions. What am I missing?
That's exactly what a distillation attack is.
But that really, I mean, like, why, if you could just do that, then, like, you didn't train models by just asking people random questions and then backing out of that, right? You just started with written corpus and grinded through it. So yeah. Why did everybody waste so much time if it was so easy?
I don't know why others, if the question is, why wouldn't people just try to grab GPT-5 through a distillation attack, I would say they probably already have. They've tried. And now, what are the outcomes? I don't know. But I wouldn't doubt whatsoever that the attack has already occurred.
Anything for the average, there's nothing average about the average cybersecurity shop, but like for the average defender, if you will, to be worried about?
Oh, this is the concern here is really for frontier models. For frontier model companies. And what's probably worth noting is Anthropic and OpenAI and Google DeepMind all have a certain sort of security policy around this. And I recall Anthropic's, they treat the model weights themselves as the equivalent of top secret information, you know, using DoD parlance. With the commensurate sort of controls that go with top secret type of information. However, distillation attacks is still really hard to defend against because it's one thing to do it from one account and just hammer away. It's another thing if you were to distribute that across multiple accounts. Okay, and if you do it across multiple accounts, then it's just harder to block.
But you would have to steal credit cards. You would have to use some sort of stolen credit cards to be able to afford to do all of that, right? Easy.
You don't have to. You can pay for this yourself. I mean, you don't need to steal anything. But
when you're having to do different accounts, what you're arguing for, and I agree with you, is just you're saying you create different users, different accounts from like as different companies, but they're fake. They're just hitting that model. You're trying to get data out of that model, information out of that model.
Right. Correct? You're asking
as
specific questions.
From one place.
Yeah, you're asking specific questions that help you understand what the weights of the model are.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. All right. Next thing on here.
Well,
so
hold on before you go.
Go for it.
But I think in the context of AI-driven attacks or AI. That's a attack against AI models. Most of us aren't at frontier companies. And so as a result, that's not as relevant. However, right. What is relevant is, of course, people using these AI systems to find vulnerabilities. And the most recent news over the last week or so is, I think it was like 600, Opus 4.6 found 500 some, almost 600 some vulnerabilities in open source code that were previously unknown. And there was another company called, I think it was Aisle, A-I-S-L-E, that found 12 OpenSSL vulnerabilities, one of which was deemed critical. And these are all validated. These aren't not like stupid AI generated.
Open with the new TLS, the new versions of TLS, not really.
I don't know what the specific vulnerability was. Okay. I was just saying these are not AI slop, is what I was going to say.
Wow.
These are validated vulnerabilities. So it portends us an interesting challenge for all of us, which is we should absolutely expect the more rapid discovery of vulnerabilities already. We should expect vulnerabilities to be discovered at a pace that is completely that we have not seen before. We should also expect to see patches come out at a pace that is not seen before. And therefore, we should also expect to see decisions around do we patch and what's the time frame for patching accelerate at the pace that we haven't seen before. What we've seen with the slow pace of waterfall development, we're going to have a similar sort of faster pace for vulnerability management or what we can call like VulnOps. I think we're going to have to find ways to automate much more of what we do in vulnerability management.
No, I think that's a really important point. I'm going to sound really old and dumb here, but this is why immutable infrastructure, and we're doing this not to pitch our product or our company, but we don't sell security. But to me, that was a non-starter. You have to do immutable infrastructure at the very basic. Like if you have to patch, you got to go quick. I don't want to patch inline. I want to replace the whole fleet. And it's and you got to do it really fast. And I know that sounds old. I know that's
no,
2010, bro.
I'll take a third and totally different perspective on it. Like I was lecturing at Tech on this at Georgia Tech on this yesterday, actually, about I was going through the life cycle of a patch, right? Now, what I was basically saying is people poke around until they find something, and gray areas, but let's just say they're either a researcher like Tilson on one end of the spectrum, meaning they're benevolent, or they're an adversary, DPRK or Iran or something on the other end of the spectrum, or criminal ops. But either way, they're looking for vulnerabilities. And to Sunil's point, now they're getting better and faster at it because of using AI to do it. But in any event, they ultimately say like, oh, boom, OpenSSL, I'm the only human being, I'm the only entity who is aware of this true zero day at this point. If they're Tilson, then they are reporting that to the OpenSSL maintainers undercover, and they're validating it, hopefully, and saying, oh, that's a good one. Yeah. Maybe we have a bug bounty program. We're going to pay you $100,000. We're going to embargo it. Please don't tell anybody. We're going to start working furiously on the patch. We're going to get done with the patch. Now we're going to release the patch 10 days later. That's really aggressive if they're really fast. So now we have a patch 10 days later. In reality, it's probably 100 days later if it's like Ivanti or Microsoft or anything, just because of scale, not because of they're slow. And at the point that they release the patch, that's going to signal to the entire good and bad community out there that there was a vulnerability, because they're going to tell everybody there was a security issue. And then the researchers on one side of the spectrum and the adversaries on the other are all going to furiously reverse engineer the patch to try to figure out what was wrong. And then the minute, you know, they're going to diff and say like post patch, they manage memory a little different in this operation. I bet it's a problem in memory management. And they're going to figure out that, and then they're going to write an exploit. And if they're a researcher, they're going to, or a freaking security vendor, they're going to scan everybody and tell you that you have vulnerabilities and you need to pay them to learn more. But if they're a bad guy, they're going to break in and harvest all your PII, yeah, if they're China or whatever it's going to be. And so the idea that we need to get better and better and better at patching just means that we are all going to get faster at the race that doesn't start until day 10 or day 100. But there will always be in that window, and especially if it was an adversary who found it and didn't call up Microsoft, they have that, and it doesn't matter how good you are patching. It doesn't make any difference whatsoever. So I feel like the point to me, and especially if adversaries and more like lay adversaries, meaning somewhere between script kiddies and cyber criminals who were just riding coattails before, if they're now finding vulnerabilities, and in particular able to find vulnerabilities in like bespoke packages and not everybody, yeah, not open source,
yeah,
then that patching is going to be too late. And I feel like, and I was preaching this 15 years ago, but I think it's just becoming more true now as that timeline condenses, that you need to be able to have vulnerable libraries, components, and be okay. And there's just simple architectural things like Log4j, right? That came out. It was a big panic. If you just didn't let all of your production servers surf the web and go out, who cared? Racing the patch instead of shutting down egress.
I got 2 points on that. Let me jump on this, Sunil. I got heat right now. I got heat on this one, all right?
Bring it, dude. Let's go.
I think the concept of script kiddie is starting to kind of fade. I think there is a democratization of malware. It's you no longer need that intelligent person working for the Chinese government or North Korea.
Agreed.
It's the game's changing so quickly. There is no more. There's no difference. It's these using AI to find these things is just getting so much faster. It doesn't matter anymore. You don't need to be an expert, is my point. You're going to find them all the time. I think what Sunil said, understanding how you're as a protector, how your application is behaving, how it works, how it connects, how all these things move together and to make a symphony, is going to become more and more important and a differentiator in companies, because that's when you know, if I make this change here, this is the impact that it potentially can happen if I do that. And knowing that is going to become much more important for the defenders.
Yeah. I obviously have religion about this. Go see
So we'll put it, I forget the exact link, but we'll put it in once we find it. But last week, within the last week, there was a release of someone has a an agent that runs and looks at the diffs between one version to the next version of open source code, and then basically says, here's the vulnerability that this code was fixing. So whatever embargoed news that we might have wanted to have for a vulnerability is no longer there anymore. It's just going to, this the site basically just publishes that for everyone to see.
And by the way, the bad guys could do that long before the site came along. So it's only a net positive that we're democratizing that.
Sure. Well, I think at some level, that's correct. You know, the NSA, we definitely had a lot of people, a lot of eyeballs looking at code and not telling people what was vulnerable in it. But anyway, that's it. Going back to a much earlier conversation we've had about the vulnerabilities being dense or bugs being dense. Again, they're very dense. You keep looking, you'll find more, right? So I think this is why we go back to the notion of we need to look at vulnerabilities not as a security problem, but as a feature problem. And when you when you see it as a feature flaw, you go and fix the feature flaw. And you can have, now that we have AI systems to help us fix those feature flaws, we don't have as much of a hindrance to getting some of these things fixed, even if it's not, even if it's not reachable. Okay, why not go ahead and fix it just so that, yeah, why not just go ahead and fix it anyway? Especially since it's just only a few.
I don't know if this is a literal corollary, but it might be. I would say kind of the opposite, which is, even if it's not vulnerable, why not take it off the internet and decommission it? Right? Like the best patch any of us have ever done in any organization is to shut stuff down.
Correct.
And when you do, you don't have to get the next 25 struts patches. Like, it's just stupid to me that people are patching things that probably shouldn't even be active or exposed.
Yeah. Well, that goes right to my DIE triad.
Yes.
The pets and the cattle. There, I don't really want to patch any cattle. I just shoot them and eat them for a steak, right? So I'm fully with you. And as long as people adhere to that model, there's not a need to.
Oh, man, you ruin it for me, Sidney. I always think of a bonsai tree where I'm taking care of it and I trim it every time and I patch a little something. And now you just brought back the animal.
Is that Sybase? Is that your Sybase instance, the way that you curate it? Yeah, that's right. Well, it's time for the public sector segment of the show. That's a joke, but it seems like it's a recurring theme. Some of the stuff that we collated here, like this national cyber strategy, instead of it being released, we just get new and updated rumors and we just comment on those. So Sunil's buddy, his best friend that he's hanging out with in Munich, Sean Cairncross, he was speaking about this cyber strategy a little bit, and then there was a bunch of industry folks who were responding about that in a recent article. And again, it was on about empowering the private sector to do more offensive ops. And somewhere in this article, like I was reading into that in past discussions on Hackback, and I still struggle with, like, even if the gloves are off and I could do anything I want, I can't think of many things I would have done, like, ever. Like, oh, cool, this compromised elementary school PC in the Netherlands attacked us. Let me burn down the elementary school. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there's never, like, attacker waving the flag laughing at me because my hands are tied. That's not the way it really works in real life. But one of the things they mentioned was canaries and decoys and that sort of thing. And in the article, it goes on to say, like, if you, and this is very common. Like, this is not, we don't need a new national cybersecurity directive for this. If you plant canaries in your environment, one, you could find out if somebody's poking around and get early detection. Like, that's kind of the core idea. But then theoretically, especially if it's a canary token, when someone reaches out and tries that credential or whatever it is, now you have their IP address and user agent and a little bit of info on them. And this story was trying to say, like, that's one of those new things that will be enabled by changes in the administration's approach, and that we need to be careful about the legal, the dubious legal situation of doing that. That ship has sailed.
What? Right?
If anybody's out there not afraid to look at the IP address of someone stealing a token, what?
Like, what?
Right? Or is there something new about deception going on that could change based on this strategy or anything else like that?
Well, it's funny because my co-founder, Gadi Evron, used to run a deception company called Symmetria. And unfortunately, right. it didn't do well because, as he puts it, nobody wanted deception. So maybe it was more so it was too early to market, right?
Yeah, he was ahead of
it. It was
time.
A good idea, Sunil. It was a good idea. I'm going to tell you, it was a good idea.
Yeah. I think so. Let's take a step back and make sure we understand. Like, what are they? What's the broader message that's being made? And the broader message is to essentially have this a strategic message, a coordinated message that is trying to change the risk calculus of the attackers, and the strategic coordinated strategic message is. That we're going to put the full brunt of a full force of our attack capability should it come to that, right? Whatever that means. I agree that it's highly unlikely that you'll have organizations that have a lot to lose be at the pointy tip of that spear. I think that we'll instead have companies to whom we give them letters or mark, whether from the government or maybe on behalf of a corporate entity, to say, please go do something for against this attacker, this threat actor on my behalf, but don't let them know that it's me, right? So I see a whole outsourcing model emerge from here, and having that. Anyway, it's sort of like a we already talked about this in the context of state nation state attackers, and or if it's a contracted group, is that still nation state, or is that you know, how do you exactly label that? That's always been a challenge for us.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess we'll see. And like, I think a parallel to this, and in particular when it comes to the cyber strategy, is CISA. So. God, we seem to talk about them a lot. I know we've, in a private sector jobs, worked with folks from there and some really good folks over time. The latest buzz there is that they got a big talking to, basically saying a lot of you are working on missions that we're going to abandon. Sounds like a more pejorative term, but they're not going to stop doing. And there's going to be new focuses, and stay tuned because there's going to be a new strategy, and there's a new document coming out for CISA specifically on their strategy and defining their mission. And then there's supposed to be some like plan of action that's going to follow on to that. And in particular, what it mentions is OT and helping out critical infrastructure operators. And in particular, I'm thinking of like water treatment plants and things like that, where versus like JP Morgan's technically critical infrastructure, but I'm going to say they probably need less help with cyber than the water treatment plant over on 17th Street. But in any event, if they're going to focus on that, so that's like the first stuff that seems to be like something that's going to survive this re-engineering. What do you think they're going to cut? What else does CISA do right now that could be on the chopping block? And should that be of concern either to the public?
In addition to what they already cut? In addition to what they already done?
Well, it seems like right now it's just mainly humans that are gone. And if, sure, whatever they're working on is probably gone. But like for a strategic, we're going to stop doing X. What would it be? Secure by design, public outreach? What else does CISA do that you think might be gone in a year?
I'm not sure what CISA does anymore, given all
I was trying to avoid saying that, but
yeah, it's I mean, it essentially has been decimated, but that's it. When you constrain resources, you start prioritizing what really, really matters, and I think it just understanding what got they prioritized. Is a double-edged sword, effectively.
Because it tells the attackers what you're
exactly.
focusing on.
Right.
And what you're not focusing on.
Exactly right. So this concern around the water infrastructure is rightly placed.
Yeah. Get rid of chloride in your water. Come on, people. We need to go do that now.
Oh, boy.
You mean fluoride or
no,
chlorine?
No, I don't believe in that. Just kidding. Kidding. It's a joke.
Yeah, get rid of chlorine in it, too. I think we're doing all right on that for my constant survival. But all right. Well, that's fair enough. Okay. Hey, we've been all over the map. We talked about AI a ton. So if you're sick of hearing about AI, let us know, and we'll try to back off a little bit. But we shifted gears into public sector. And then last thing we want to talk about, and this didn't make the – we ran out of time last time here, so this is a little bit old news, but less than a month. Our GTIG and Google Threat Intelligence Group, they released some information about a massive, world's largest proxy network, residential relays, that sort of thing, that was disrupted. Will this have a – I remember this sounds like something we've talked about in the past. Will this have a noticeable impact on what? Cybercrime, other things? Is there any like anything to learn from this or any patterns, any new capabilities that we could take away?
So let's talk about what this is. So a residential proxy network comes because someone signs up for something that allows you to make some money, maybe sometimes make money, by sharing your bandwidth essentially at home. You're not at home, maybe you're at work and you have all this idle bandwidth. So why don't you run this app or buy this product, or sometimes stereotypically, they've already bought a product and don't realize that it's part of this residential proxy network. Anyway, there's a number of reasons why these things emerge. But one of the most common ways is actually just apps. Like, so app builders, they find a way to monetize their app by installing something that creates a residential proxy without you knowing when you run that app on your phone or whatever else it might be. So anyway, so that's what this is. Now, of course, you can imagine the biggest abuser of these proxy networks are the attackers who are going to commit crime and other sort of things. So that's kind of what was disrupted. And it was, I think Google found like a small handful of operators of these residential proxy networks and did the appropriate takedown. What I think is also fascinating about this, though, is that these residential proxy networks were of course, residential. The point that it being residential, it makes it really hard for one to determine that if it's coming from a data center, it's one thing. If it's coming from a residential network, you generally would think it's a user, right? If you're trying to scrape content, if you're trying to log into bank accounts and so on and so forth, just makes more sense to come from a residential network. What with agentic AI,
make a lot of social media posts drumming up false interest or
absolutely yes, or a bunch of OpenClaw bots basically interacting with e-commerce sites that expect residential users, not people coming from AWS or GCP. So that's kind of what we're seeing. And I think with agents now also entering the picture, it's going to get even more confusing because guess what? I actually do have a agent that represents me, but it's running out of Azure, okay? And one of the most painful parts of running it in Azure is I keep getting blocked by people who want me to come out of a residential network rather than a data center. Anyway, we're going to see more and more people say, hey, why can't my agent do whatever? We're going to have to start downgrading our ability to block things because it's coming from... The residential networks make it hard for us to determine good from bad, right? But now, if we just make all data centers all of a sudden good again, that makes it much harder for us to block things that... that should be blocked.
I'm not too hurt by this because, I mean, I think a recurring theme on this is that things are bad not because of who they are, but because of what they do. And So anything that was statically trying to make associations and say, oh, this is residential, so it gets a free pass, and this is from Azure, and it gets a no, was always destined for failure. So perhaps we're just forcing the issue here. And like when you think about like Cloudflare is very well known, they're in the news a lot lately for doing not just bot blocking, but bot pay to play. Mm-hmm. really, to the benefit of the customers too. So it's not like they're just, you know, extorting it or something like that. I'm assuming that they weren't saying, oh, this is the Justice data center and we're going to block that and Azure, but residents, we're going to get a free pass. I mean, I think they got to do smarter things than that, right?
Yeah, it's really about resource consumption to get that additional context and do that analytical, make that analytical decision. It's essentially, it's a fraud decision. It's a fraud algorithm that has to run behind the scenes to say, is this a legit person, whether they're coming from a data center or not. But that all takes resources and time, and there's a latency aspect of it too.
Despite my rage, I'm still just a rat in a cage, man. That's especially all I'm getting using a proxy out of this.
Man, it's funny though. Like, I had someone, a friend who's nothing all to do with really technology, but certainly not cybersecurity, a fellow dad of young kids. And he said, hey, Jerry, could you, you know, maybe, super nice guy. Like, he said, I know you're busy, probably can't do this, but if you could give us a little talk about like how to secure home networks and that kind of thing. And he got me thinking, like, I should do that. He deserves that. A lot of people do. And then where do I start and how do I make the most effective use of the time? And I literally put a calendar item for next week that I'm just going to sit around and stare at the ceiling and think on this for 90 minutes. That's what you got to do. But the thing that I immediately knew was going to make the cut was don't use VPN services, just like full stop. Like don't. And if this guy at church happens to also be an Iranian dissident on the weekends, then he's going to get burned by my advice. But I think he's not. So I'm just going to say that and make it super, super simple. Don't worry about VPNs. And here's another reason, right? You're enabling these giant criminal networks that are rerouting through. I think this story, the Google bust, named explicitly like 12 or 15 of these VPN services alone that were just this one actor. And God knows how many more there are.
Heard here first. This is Jerry's VPN jihad. So he's been going at this for a while.
That's right. If you want to use VPN, use Cloudflare Warp to tunnel into your data center. That's what VPN used to mean and what it should be. Or Cisco AnyConnect. I'll even throw that one out there.
I'm guessing that NordVPN won't be sponsoring this podcast.
Well, what was that? There was just some partnership with them and CrowdStrike, I think. And oh man, I was just like, come on, are you kidding me? But yeah, no, I mean, they'll probably be like racing to sponsor the podcast so that they can, correct.
Trust me, folks, if you listen to these podcasts, Jerry can talk about this for days. I'm not kidding.
We'll keep resisting.
This is one of his, I'm telling you, it's one of his jihads, man.
100% true. It used to be proxy servers. It still is. They're not blue code anymore.
Now mine's WAF.
Your mother-in-law's Android. All right. Awesome. This was fun, guys. I just really like how we're just riff off a lot of this stuff and go in different directions. We're getting closer and closer to RSA. The three of us will all be there. You know, if anybody wants to meet up while we're out there, definitely do that. And as we assemble all the activities we're doing, all of that, we'll share when it gets closer to the event. But otherwise, thanks a lot, guys. And I'm looking forward to seeing you again soon already.
Thanks.